So I am meeting with you all today as a member of our racial justice group, and I'm excited to talk to you about Native American history. I will be honest, I am not an expert in this area, and I find that that is just one of the key components for racial justice, is knowing that we are not experts, and just making sure that we are in an open space and we feel like we can learn together. And unfortunately, now my PowerPoint is being sad and not starting. But what is important too is just to recognize that we are here meeting virtually in your homes or here at St. Andrews in a land that is, oh no, that is not good. That is the Duwamish people. And so it's important to recognize that this space of ours, that we are graciously using this space. And one day, my PowerPoint will start up again. What I had, if you guys were joining in earlier, was just some music playing from Duwamish people. I had music with the drums as well as chants. And music is one of the best ways to help share the stories and continue the ties of culture. So I just always like to share something fun and interesting to listen to. And hopefully I'll be able to share that again with you all at some point. There. Can you guys hear the flute? Perfect. We're back on track, everyone. Happy Sunday in this new hybrid format. But yes, so here we are at St. Andrew's Church, acknowledging our faith. And there are fun sites that you guys can utilize yourself to help know where your address is located. I am originally from Connecticut, so it was interesting to see about the Native tribes from Connecticut as well. And you can find all of that on the site that is on the screen, native-land.ca. So the first activity that I wanted to do with you all is to think about what's in a name. And so it's helpful to think of the Native American people as looking at the history and connections that they have with the space, looking at the importance of land in your community and how that ties into your name. And so what I'd like you to do is think about your own origin of your name with your neighbors. And you can think of it from the Where I Am From poem, which is published originally by Ella Lyon. And so you think, I am from space, an everyday item in your home, from something that, a product from everyday items in your home, thinking about like what has influenced you when you were a child, thinking about those memories that you're tied to on your specific street. So I would say that I am from dirt roads accompanied with trees and family. I am from laughter and struggle as we dealt with power. I am from roots established from third grade from my parents moving just next door. I'm from pancakes and waffles for dinner. I'm from Sunday night movies and Friday night pizzas. I'm from just love and joy. So just thinking about like different ways, think about who you are and how that might connect to your name. So you are welcome to utilize the Where I Am From poem in your own contemplations about who you are and that tie. And this is also just helpful in knowing more about the Native American history. As you specifically look at this region in regards to salmon, how salmon has held onto their family, how their families are tied to the salmon migration, and how the production of salmon is tied to their culture. But it's just a fun activity to think about and always good for reflection. And so this is a speaker from TED Talk who is also an artist, Native American artist. His name is Greg Deal. And he talks about in this clip about his journey as an artist and utilizing his talents to describe the struggles of his culture. And he, in particular, this is an older clip, so some of the references that he has, like, for example, the tribal football teams, names are no longer in play, that's recent changes, but the story is important.
Before I get started, I want to take the opportunity to recognize that we are...
And I'm just going to start playing at 7 minutes in just to make sure we respect our time. And he introduces his family and his stories as well, so... It's a fun clip to listen to if you would like the whole clip.
So this brings me to my work. As an artist, I've found that the only way to function as an artist is that you have to work within the bounds of what Western culture expects you to do. They expect us to be painting cowboys and Indians. People are heading down to Santa Fe and they want to buy a nice Indian painting by a nice Indian to put in their home because it's Indian. And as a result of that, we're one of the few subcultures in the art world that is actually being controlled by a Western buyer's market that decides whether or not there's value with our stories. And it's a risk. I mean, if I do anything different than that, it is an inherently professional risk. So I've decided to take a professional risk. I'm working under the premise of what does contemporary indigenous art look like when it is not informed by a Western buyer's market. So the first piece I created for that is this piece. It is a self-portrait. I was in kindergarten, and it's a seemingly innocent image, but it's titled Prairie Nigger, because that's what the kids called me when I was a kid. I went to an all-white school. I was the brownest kid that was in school, and that is what they called me. And I don't say that to be decisive or blasé about a word, but to illustrate the intersectionality that exists within the language of racism and intolerance. And this is how I experienced it at the age of 5 or 6 years old. And this is not a unique story for Indigenous children. This is happening all over the country. And the reason for that is because nobody has any context to who or what a Native person is. There is no value to our stories. In fact, this piece has been rejected from 2 shows, one of which they asked me to bring the piece, and 2 days later said, we can't hang this because of the word that's there for a Native voice group show. So you can see there's not even space for our stories, the stories that don't make sense, the stories that don't fall in line with that cowboy and Indian narrative. I just finished this piece. I don't have a title for it yet. I was talking to a good friend of mine. He's from a neighboring tribe, the Timok Western Shoshone. And his people went to the same boarding school as my people did. My grandparents went to Stewart Indian School. It's in Nevada. And he told me this story they heard from his elders, and I wanted to share it with you guys. The story goes, there was this young boy, he's about 5 or 6 years old, and he shows up at the boarding school. If you don't know what a boarding school is, please look it up. It is a forced assimilation school where culture was literally beaten out of Indigenous children. They started in 1879, and they went clear up into the 2000s. And what has happened is this boy shows up. They cut his hair. They scrub him clean. They put this burning talc on him, right, to get rid of the lice because they think Indians are dirty. And then the woman who's bathing him realizes that his elbows and his knees are darker than the rest of him, which is common for people who have a little melanin in their skin. And so she assumes he's dirty, and she scrubs his elbows, and she scrubs his knees. And she takes the skin off until they're bleeding. And he goes to bed, and he's crying, and he's upset. And he spends most of the night crying. And when they come back in to find out what all the noise is, and they turn the lights on, they see that he's soiled the sheets with his blood. So they grab him out, they take him into another room, and they beat him for the next hour. All the kids in the boarding school can hear what's happening. And then it goes silent. And those kids never saw that child again. I wanted to paint this picture because this is what I thought of. A child standing naked and afraid with bloody elbows and with bloody knees. And under the things that I've told you, under the requirements that we have in order to be the best Indian we can for you, these stories don't matter. I maintain that they do matter. And I'm standing here as a result of I stand here as a protest of the policies that were put upon Indigenous people. I stand here in spite of those things. I am my grandparents' greatest dreams that were never supposed to come true. And now, I hope I've told you something new. And I think I have. I hope that I've told you something maybe even shocking. And now you're all responsible for that information. Stories are to be carried. Stories are to be held. Stories are to be revered. What are you going to do with that information? If you leave here and you decide to do nothing, you are complicit in the actions of those who came before you who helped you get to this place. Your ancestors, whoever they may be. But maybe ask yourself this. Are you making spaces for Indigenous people in your home and in your workplace? Are you creating inclusion in those places? Are you realizing that as you walk these lands, that there are people who walk these lands before you? That these are sacred and important things? And that Indigenous people are still here? And that we matter? And we will always matter, because this is the land of our inheritance. This is the land that the Creator gave us. So what are you going to do with that information? Thank you.
Hopefully that clip makes you think of new things with the Where I'm From poem, especially when he said he was the product of his grandparents' greatest dreams that they never thought would come true. And I was just reflecting again from Connecticut. In our textbooks, the Native American story was very traditional in terms of Thanksgiving, Plymouth Rock, all that fun jazz, happy-go-lucky world with the relationships that existed. We didn't hear about any of the other struggles that might have happened in the area. We didn't learn about the land and how they moved away from that land and what that looked like. Just basic stats and statistics, maybe a few different articles depending on the history teacher and what personal work that they would have invested into the class. So just a reflection point for everyone here, whether you're at home or in the chat, it's like, what does the relationship between Washington State look like with the different tribes? From what you know, would you say it was happy-go-lucky? It's kind of scary, mischievous faces or angry faces. And you are welcome to use poll. There's a pollEverywhere.com. If you text Becca Peel 230, you could make a response look like that, but it's okay. We don't have to do it. Just in general, would we do thumbs up, thumbs down in the middle in this room here? Never thought it was good. Thanks. Yep. Any other thoughts about the relationship? And Jean said, it depends on who's looking. That's a fair comment. So Jean was talking about different perspectives. Any other thoughts from the room?
We've had some entries in the chat. Mm-hmm. Very poor, not good. Good for white people, lousy for tribes.
Yeah.
White supremacy at its finest.
Exactly. Perfect. And I appreciate the chat responses. So if we look at Washington history, and I'll be honest again, this is a lot of new information for me. I didn't know about the fish wars that existed out here. It's not something that was taught to me from Connecticut. So I found it was very interesting to learn a lot more about it. But if we look at Washington history, especially in the Puget Sound area, you have archaeological evidence that links humans started about 12,000 years ago, where they found different discoveries that they could even have been here longer. So the tribes from present-day Olympia to and from the Cascade Crest to the Kitsap Peninsula all share a common language. But there are different dialects within the tribal groups. But many of the cultural practices and traditions center around salmon. And that's why in art you see a lot of the salmon or orca depictions. A lot of the group activities are centered around salmon collection, how you then store salmon and just pass it out to your different neighbors. Yeah. We have a question from the crowd. Yes. I think because it's something that our committee is looking at in general as like the intersegregation between different racial groups and the justice overall. So how can we make sure that intersectionality is being respected? So that's something that we've talked about and ways that we can look at maybe with our annual meeting is having a land acknowledgement at that meeting as well. So the practices that we can do to make sure that we are coming from an equitable standpoint. Great question. But we had questions about, like, so we have a land acknowledgement. What does that actually mean? And what does that do for anyone? Is there any follow-up action? And so we were talking about, like, what additional steps can we take? And it was shared that there are ways that you can then pay rent towards different tribal organizations if you have that land acknowledgement in place. You can also give funds to those groups so that they can support different cultural practices that they have. And here we can start learning more about this.
This Fish Wars thing may, at first, may seem a little complicated.
But I think if you look closer, you'll find it's very simple.
First, a brief background. A long time ago, the Indians of the Pacific Northwest had a pretty good deal. They had what must have seemed like an endless supply of food.
Salmon, varieties of fresh fruits, cedar and fir trees.
Medicines, elk.
Bear.
Cultural connections with neighboring tribes.
Art, music, dance.
Clean water, and best of all, a giant supply of salmon.
Now, the fish wars. Look at the fish wars as four simple truths.
People moving from the east to the west did so to get land.
The Indians were coerced to trade away some of their land through a bunch of treaties to the United States.
Why would they trade away their land? To keep access to food.
Our ancestors traded land for us to have access to our foods. So that was our very first conversation. Because we know, even in our oral traditions, that when we are not eating our traditional foods, when they cease to exist, then so do we as a people.
Okay. Who would not protect their right to exist?
So, simple truth number one. Indians did sign treaties that ceded some of their land, but they did not cede all of their lands or their rights to their food.
Okay, the tribes had everything. They had the land. They had everything. They granted certain rights to the United States, and that was land. But they reserved all those rights they had before.
They reserved the right to fish, hunt, and gather in their usual and accustomed lands and waters. Forever. Even on lands they had ceded.
Forever.
Sir, forever. Like, infinity forever.
Jump ahead. The Northwest Territory becomes the states of Washington and Oregon.
Thousands more people arrive out of the sunrise, looking for free land. And now, even free natural resources. Lumber, minerals, fish.
To increase their control over natural resources, the salmon, the new state governments create laws restricting the Indians' treaty rights to fish.
So, simple truth number two, states can't do that.
There was a tremendous amount of harassment and persecution prosecutions by the respective game departments of the state of Oregon, the state of Washington, on tribes who were attempting to assert their traditional rights that were secured by treaties.
And even though the United States issued court orders to stop bothering the Indians who were fishing, the states of Washington and Oregon kept violating the Indians' treaty rights.
And that brings us to simple truth number three.
Time to take it to the streets.
Well, in this case, take it to the water. Fish war.
Finally, simple truth number four. It sometimes gets personal.
I think we have to blame some of the problems that tribes face on racism. I think we have to be honest about that. It is racism because we don't want another group to have something we don't have.
As much as we wish it weren't so, when different cultures collide...
And there are disagreements, good old Mr. Racism is often to blame. So the simple facts of fish wars are...
By the numbers. One.
Indians did sign treaties with the United States that gave up some of their land, but they did not give up their rights to fish.
Two.
States did pass laws that violated those treaties, and states can't do that.
Three.
When all else fails, in America, you can always take it to the water.
And four.
Yes, in conflicts like these. Sadly, racism is usually hidden in there somewhere.
Sir, I don't think it was hidden at all.
In four simple truths, that's the truth.
Valerie Segrist.
Elizabeth Furs.
John Platt.
But yeah, so the site is continuously being updated because there are still new court cases, new actions that youth are taking, as well as other groups to look at the impact still of the fish wars on this area. And so learning about this was really interesting for me because I did not know about it. And so they gained, maybe you guys recall different articles or any sort of the sit-ins that happened during this time period about the fish wars. The issue being that when you look at indigenous people, they're nations, and the states cannot create treaties with other nations. That is, a U.S. as a nation is supposed to be doing that. And so that's what the court cases were looking at, the interpretation of indigenous people as a nation versus states' ability to take away those rights. And that's why you have the different decisions in court and why the interpretations have resulted in the fish wars. And the image is small, sorry, for people in the room, but there are different sites, locations on that map that look specifically at sit-in locations or other treaties and where they took place. So we look at the impact of justice. Through the court case, you're able to see more of the land acknowledgement that has been happening across the years and to look at the connection with salmon and why the fish wars are so important from the clip and the audio